Good evening, everyone. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters yet again, and Paradigm Shifters are people that are making a difference on our planet. And today we're talking about making a difference in the world of healing, of health, in the medical world, in the world of love and humor, and how it all comes together in our bodies, in our minds, in our reality. I have a very exciting guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who wrote Mind, Medicine, and Miracles many years ago, and I believe that really carved a niche in the consciousness of our species, don't you think? So welcome to the show, Dr. Siegel.
Oh, thank you.
I think you really made a difference. Do you think so?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. That as a doctor, I think I was more threatening, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but, you know, like Norman Cousins had an experience with a disease, and he wrote about it.
Yeah, and he really shook a lot of us up many, many years earlier.
Yeah, you know, how humor and, you know, his beliefs and did things. But, you see, I think doctors could say, that's an anecdote, that's Norman Cousins, and who knows if he ever had, it, you know, that problem. And it's easy for them to put him down.
And he's a good writer.
Yeah, but when a doctor comes up and says something, it's harder for the medical profession to ignore it and to say, well, it's an anecdote. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And so I was on all the famous talk shows with doctors telling me, you know, it doesn't make sense, or I'm blaming patients if I ask them what's happening in their life. That means it's their fault they got sick. So they were misinterpreting everything I was trying to say.
Well, they're protecting themselves, weren't they?
Pardon?
They were really protecting themselves
and
their domain.
Yeah, the thing they would say is, I can't accept that. Mm-hmm. And I realized because they couldn't explain something or understand something, it was easier to just totally block it out.
Mm-hmm.
See, I always say quantum physicists and astronomers don't say, I can't accept it. I mean, the universe is here. The fact that you can't explain it doesn't make it go away.
That's right.
But that's how doctors would act because they weren't exposed to these things during their training.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that made them uncomfortable. And if I talked about a certain article or a journal, they'd say it's poorly controlled. And, you know, just looking for excuses to not have to accept what I was saying.
Well, because you're actually tearing up both the marketplace and the paradigm in which they existed.
It's really why I became a storyteller, because that allowed them to listen without feeling, you know, that there was anything to fight over or have conflict over. Because they could walk out of a meeting saying, that was an anecdote. That was a case history. So, you know, they don't have to shift their beliefs. But the reason it worked was, then they would have something interesting happen in their practice, and they'd think, he'll get a kick out of this, and then I'd get a call. Or if it was in the hospital and they saw that something helped the patient, they would begin to do it, mostly through the nurses. See, the nurses would share things about Dr. Siegel's crazy patients and that they were doing well. Then the other doctors would say, if it's good for the patient, okay. Because they always said, nobody was against success.
Mm-hmm.
But if you lectured on why, then we'd get into arguments. But if you did it for a few months and it worked, then the next thing you know, the whole hospital's doing it and there are no more arguments. And literally, it took about 4 or 5 years before I got invited to give conferences where everybody sat comfortably and listened to me, because now they had experienced what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, it's taken 20 or 30 years, I would get criticized for not doing research. But if nobody believe me, I got in touch with National Institutes of Health, the American Cancer Society, and they're all looking at me like, you know, you're nuts. We're not going to give you money to do research. Or they'd send me, you know, a stack of papers to fill out, which is a foot high. And I'm in practice. I mean, I'm not an academician at a university. I can't sit for 2 months filling out forms. So, but what happens? 10 or 20 years or 30 years later, the beliefs have shifted and the research is done on laughter, on loneliness, on music, you know, and how they affect people and their ability to heal and all kinds of things. So
are you still being a doctor?
Am I? Yes, but not a surgeon. I mean, I'm a doctor in the sense of working with people with life-threatening illnesses and other problems and showing them what I call survival behavior.
Hmm.
In other words, you know, see, if you were opening a business, you
right.
would say, let me look around, see who's been successful, and learn from them.
Right.
But if you go to a doctor, and the doctor says, gee, you got a 10% chance of surviving, and you said, well, what did the 10% do? the doctor would probably say, I don't know what they do. I mean, they're lucky people. I give them the treatment. You see, and that's what I learned. It's not just about luck. There's survival behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody said to me, how do I behave so I'm more likely to survive? You're darn right. I got a list. I mean, some of it's on my website, Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com. So there's an immune competent personality. There are many stories, which include, you see, if you're battling and waging a war against your disease, you're empowering your enemy.
Right.
You're not healing your life.
And your biochemistry gets really flipped
up. That's right.
Yeah.
So I try to get people to understand what we're trying to do. I was just sending a note to a reporter, and she was asking about examples. And I have one wonderful letter from a lady. She was ill for quite a while, and there were times the doctor would tell her she's going to die and she would fight it. But she said, this last time, I thought, the doctor's right. I have a couple of months. Mm. So she said, I went home and I bought a dog and I put in a backyard wildlife habitat and I laughed more and I took vitamins. And it goes on. And the letter, the second page of the letter ends with, and now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? I didn't die. And that's why she was writing me. See, I'm exhausted. I burst out laughing.
Exhausted by success.
Yeah, I had to call her and say, look, go take a nap. You know, see, she's burning up, not burning out.
Yeah.
And now that her body knows she's loving her life, look what happens. She doesn't die. Solzhenitsyn, in his book Cancer Ward, that's something that really impressed me, because from my experience, you see, if you say to a doctor, you know, when somebody gets well when they're not supposed to, they call it a spontaneous remission.
Yes.
Or sometimes you've had a miracle. You know, like I went to Lourdes, and believe me, there are documented cases. You go to Lourdes, your cancer disappears, you come home. But what Solzhenitsyn talked about, when the men are sitting around and one of them says, they're all in the hospital, I found this book in the medical library. It says there are cases of self-induced healing.
Hmm.
And boy, when I read that on that page, I thought, this guy, and he's had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming from an intuitive place.
Hmm.
Self-induced, see, not spontaneous remission. And the other was, he described it as a rainbow-colored butterfly fluttering out of the book. And I thought, he's got it. Because the butterfly is the symbol of transformation.
Right.
And the rainbow, every color literally is an emotion. I mean, when you work with drawings in therapy, every color means something. Like purple is spiritual, yellow is energy. So you get everything in order, and you transform your life, restore it to order, and self-induced healing occurs. And, yeah, in two sentences, he put everything. And that's what I try to help people do. Rebirth themselves. Create the life they want to live, not one imposed on them. Do what feels good. Accept your mortality and enjoy the day.
Hmm.
And then you add to the number of days.
Hmm.
Because, again, how your body responds. And people have to remember, genes aren't the ones deciding things. There's something called epigenetics. In other words, there's an internal environment, just what you were saying. It's like the biochemistry of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what triggers off genetic activities. And it's no different than bacteria and viruses resisting antibiotics and vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
They're changing their genetic makeup. Is it easy for us? No, we have a lot more complicated lives. But the capability, see, the potential is built into us. And again, just the way a wound heals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're built for survival. But if you don't like your life, you know, think of Monday morning with the heart attack, stroke, suicides, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
What,
or if you're always in a victim role, like the world
see,
commands me to be this way. Yeah.
And then your body says, okay, I'll get you out of here. You know,
even spontaneous remission kind of puts us in a victim or a responder role, doesn't it?
Yeah, but when it's self-induced, then you empower yourself.
Yeah,
you're the responsible participant, which, again, a lot of people are afraid of because of how they're brought up. I'll do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If I read his book and I join his group and I don't get better, it means I didn't love enough. Or, that's the guilt, shame, and blame that I found really tragic, because I was fortunate enough to grow up loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't understand what other people were going through.
How come you did? We're fortunate to grow up loved. Like, did your parents, were they always loved, or is it in the essence of your being to create
that?
Well,
I think that it was my parents and my grandparents.
Mm.
Who, and that's why I really say to people, why are your children's children called grand, and the next group is called great and grand. And I think that that by having my grandparents, because I won't get into details, but I was born an ugly duckling. Let's just leave it at that. It had a lot to do with birth trauma and problems of my mother's health. But I had a grandmother who had no problem accepting me and loving me and massaging me and, to quote my mother, pushing all the parts back where they belong.
Aww.
That's a quote from my mother. So I grew up with this love around me and mottos, what I call mottos to live by. Do what'll make you happy. Mm-hmm. Troubles with God's redirections. You see, when you talk to people, I got to know Norman Vincent Peale years ago. His mother used to say, Norman, if God slams one door further down the corridor, another will be opened. So look how he grows up, see, mm-hmm. versus someone else who says, my mother's words were eating away at me and gave me cancer, maybe,
mm-hmm.
Because her mother was always putting her down and dressing her in dark clothes so nobody would notice her.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and those are... And those aren't the worst stories, believe me.
But you can change those messages if you get if you get into yourself, right?
I call it reparenting. Mm-hmm. That if somebody else comes along who loves you, you know, be it a teacher or someone else or a doctor, then they help reparent you and change you. And if they don't, then you have to work on yourself, and that's hard work. But that's, again, part of what we try to accomplish in the groups, to let people know that they are divine, they are beautiful children, and you know, we're here to love them and help them to heal themselves in their lives.
Well, and that's wonderful, and you're really very effective. And you're sending ripples throughout the medical community as well, or the healing consciousness of our planet. I know that. And your latest book is called 101 Exercises for the Soul. So, Dr. Siegel, is this a book... Is this kind of techniques for people to use to enter their psychology and enter their spirituality so that they can, you know, evolve out of the parent trap?
I'm glad you asked that, because part of the problem is, you know, if I said to everybody, I want you to read, you know, a Buddhist text, the Bhagavad Gita, or I want you to read the Bible, or, you know, a whole host of people would come back and say, well, I'm not sure what he's trying to say, or what that parable is about. And so what I try to do really is make it practical. You know, so if they read what Bernie Siegel said, they know what to do, how to go home and do it. Because there's a book that also kind of goes with it called 365 Prescriptions for the Soul. And again, it's messages with solutions, S-O-U-L.
I like
that. And these are exercises. In other words, things that people can do, ways of thinking and activities that they can perform that are practical and fit their life.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, they can read this and say, okay, thank you. I like to think of myself as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about rehearsing and practicing. And if they're willing to show up for rehearsals and practice, then some wonderful things will happen.
Well, I like the idea of being an adult with a very childish nature at times and having my own box of crayons.
Yeah.
That's something you recommend. You want to talk a bit about that?
Well, because the intuition, in other words, the inner wisdom can speak through dreams and drawings. So I do it a lot with people when they say, gee, should I have an operation? I say, draw a picture of yourself in the operating room. Or I had a doctor friend. He said, I'm thinking of getting married. I said, draw the women you're thinking of marrying. Or if you said, where should I live? What job should I take? Draw your options. And then we sit down and look at them, see? And there's an inner wisdom that knows what's right for you. But it's not always what your head agrees with. If the two agree, wonderful, go. It'll be a beautiful picture. But, you know, a doctor could say to somebody, it doesn't have to be surgery or chemotherapy, say, you need to eat vegetables. And somebody hates vegetables and would rather have medicine and eat a lobster once in a while, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the kitchen could look awful. Everybody's upside down. Or you draw the operating room and there's nobody there taking care of you. See? Now, the other happens too. Somebody says, I don't want that treatment. And they draw a beautiful picture. And I say, you know it's good for you. And I can help people reprogram themselves through the use of imagery. You can visualize yourself going to the operating room, having surgery, doing well, going home in a day, and everything's fine. And you picture that three or four times a day for a week, your body thinks you've had you know, 25 operations and have done well. And so when you go for surgery, you do beautifully because you have reprogrammed your mind and body.
Because your cells are really getting with you, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you're getting a message. I always talk about, you know, use the symbolism of cells, like prison cells, to open every cell in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to the love and the light and the wisdom. And then very different reaction happens.
So what is this theme song?
What do you mean?
Well, in one of yours, let me see, I've got it marked here, you sang Create Your Own Theme Song.
What's my theme song?
No, your theme song. I think it's like to find our own song.
Yeah.
And in some of my work, I get people to do an old Sufi thing, which is to sing their name over and over again in any tune they
cool.
want.
Yeah.
And I wondered, it's similar in a way, doesn't
yeah,
it?
I tell people to pick a new name.
Oh, great.
You see, because, again, it's like the born-again symbolism. If you create the true self, the authentic self, you can eliminate your disease. So I will say, okay, pick a new name, and let's start a new life.
Well, you know, that's a big statement. If you can get to your true self, you can eliminate the disease. I like
that's why I was thinking a few minutes ago, because you keep saying Dr. Siegel. Mm-hmm. I'm Bernie.
Bernie. Thanks, Bernie.
and I can't help it. You know, if you know, even in the office, I would say to people, you know, if you want to call me Dr. Siegel because you say, well, you spent all those years in school, fine. They're honoring me, but mm-hmm. I would give them all permission to call me Bernie, because that's who I felt comfortable being, you know, and it didn't put a burden on me to just be Bernie.
That's great.
So I say to people, find out who you are and be comfortable with that and then live your life. That's why, not what's imposed by authorities. You see, again, when you get into statistics, you have twin sisters. Who's more likely to get breast cancer? The good little girl who internalizes anger and pleases her parents, or the kid who's a little devil who's bellowing when she's not happy and doing her thing.
Mm-hmm, right.
And if you ask an audience, everybody votes for the good kid. And it's true. So that's why I want people to sing their song and not the song and the lyrics that's imposed upon them.
I love that. And you've got breathing exercises. I'm not going to go through this whole book because I want to pick your brains about some other things
go
as
ahead,
well.
Sure.
Although this, I tell people that this is a wonderful book for quick references to
yes.
things that you can do. And I have the 300.
Let me add this. I tell people, don't start at the beginning and go straight through.
Right.
Because, again, I always feel the unconscious takes you to the right page. So mm-hmm. I keep my own books next to my bed and I flip them open and just see what's the message for the day. And it is right on so often.
So, Bernie, let's go back to being your true nature and your authentic self,
yeah.
which I really, I just espouse that as much as I can. I didn't say despise, I said espouse.
Right.
Just making sure here. And I was wondering, as when you were young, did you have an inkling or a dream that you were going to like break open out of the way society was? Did you have any kind of drive
like that?
What's
interesting, two things. One, my mother tells me, which I have no memory of, that when I was 7 years old, I told her I was going to be a doctor. She said, we were walking down the street on vacation, and I just turned to her and said, I'm going to be a doctor. I have no memory of that, even thinking about it in high school and so forth.
Hmm.
But in college, I began to think, how can I, you know, what make use of myself? What can I do? I loved artwork, painting, but I didn't know that artists earned a living. I mean, this may sound crazy to people, but I had no concept of artworks in museums, you know, where you sold paintings. I mean, to me, it was like being decorating. So I thought, I don't want to do that. That doesn't have any meaning in it. So you got good hands. You could be a surgeon because science fascinated me and people I loved. So I thought, put it all together and become a doctor. But then came the pain. I couldn't fix everything. I can't cure everybody. And I like people, and they're dying and having problems. And boy, so again, the future is unconsciously prepared. So I decided, I saw an advertisement for a workshop to help cancer patients. I thought, oh, good, I'll go. And I got there thinking it was for doctors because of the title of it. There are 125 patients, two psychotherapists, and Siegel sitting there. And here were my patients. And what changed my life was a patient of mine sat down next to me. See, there was nothing to separate us. And I ultimately went back to the office and put the desk against the wall, so I was not separated from people. But she said to me, "Bernie, you're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits."
Wonderful.
And that's when I started support groups. And they taught me what I needed to know to help other cancer patients. Hmm. But let me add this interesting comment. This was a weekend workshop. I came back to the office on Monday, and one of my partners looked at me and he said, "You're gone." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You're not the same person anymore. You're gone." And, I mean, I thought he was nuts. But he could see the impact of that weekend on me. Hmm. And he was right.
Was he also a doctor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a surgeon, too.
Oh, wow.
Very intuitive guy, Dick Zelzer. He'd written books, too. But, you know, he was right. About 13 years later, I left surgery. But I started support groups the next year and the next fall, and then off I went into a whole new world. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, that's a really good story, actually. So what you're saying is our authentic nature this is how I'm interpreting it. The authentic nature comes through our experiences with all these biddings from what comes to you, the synchronicities that come to you, right?
Yeah.
But it was already in your nature to become someone who changes the face of things.
Yeah. You know, that's why I say that when you get back to the feelings and doing what feels right and stop thinking so much, mm-hmm. That's when the right things happen. You know, that's why, you know, as I said, what Jung said, that we are creating our future by the choices we make. You know,
in
whether
every
you're listening
moment.
To this program, reading a book, going for a walk, I mean, everything affects the future for us.
Mm-hmm. Bernie, have you ever had one of those incredible health challenges? Not being a handsome baby?
The things that have affected me that were early on, I almost choked to death on a toy and left my body. I had a near-death experience when I was 4 years old.
Oh, my.
And boy, now this may surprise you, but I was mad as hell when I didn't die.
No, that doesn't surprise me.
4 years old and leaving your body. And see, the thing that whenever I thought about it, and I would talk about me was the part that left, watching this kid on the bed die. Hmm. I did not associate myself with the body. I associated myself with the consciousness that left the body.
Hmm.
So that was interesting. And I've had some other mystical experiences. I've done guided imagery, which I didn't believe in, and yet, because I was very visual as an artist, when I closed my eyes, it was quite impressive as to what happened, and I visualized meeting a guide named George. And I was disappointed because I thought, you're a doctor, if I'm walking on this path, I'll meet Jesus or Moses or, you know, and then this guy named George shows up. But twice I've had healers and mystics come up to me while I've been speaking and say, there was a man standing in front of you or next to you while you were lecturing. And they drew his picture. And it's exactly what I drew in a picture of my guide. Because I drew a picture once for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross of a meditation image I had. And she told me so much about my life that that's what made me go back and ask patients to start drawing pictures. Because I drew this outdoor scene and myself sitting there with my guide and certain other symbols. And she started asking me questions that were just so profound about myself. And I thought, where is this coming from? And it was all in this outdoor scene that I drew. I mean, to give people an example, she said to me, "What are you covering up?"
Oh.
I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You put snow on a mountain." I said, "Yeah, it's a mountain with snow." She said, "Bernie, the page is white. You took a white crayon and added a layer on top of it." And what I was covering up, all my emotions and feelings, you know, as I mentioned, the pain of being a surgeon. So when she started asking questions like that, I thought, holy smokes, this is amazing. And that's when, again, I began to get into people's minds.
And your own.
See, that's when you start reading, you find out Carl Jung, I don't know, maybe 90 years ago, interpreted a dream and made a diagnosis of a brain tumor. I have never met a doctor who's been told that while in training. Because I think we ought to say to patients, what are you dreaming?
Yes, exactly.
What inner wisdom do you have about what's going on in your body? And I really used to listen to that in the office when people would come in and say, I know my mammogram's okay, but I am feeling something different that's not right. And, yeah, I'd listen to those women and do a biopsy. And it was amazing how often there'd be an early cancer. And so, you know, where a lot of families would come in and say, you know, my mother's crazy. She has all these dreams. And then I would come out and say, you got a wonderful mother. They'd think, oh, we got a crazy doctor. He agrees with my mother. But, you know, a woman comes in and says, I had a dream. And a cat walked up to me and said, my name is Miracle. And here's the chemotherapy you should take. Now, how does that happen? You know, this is a woman who's not a health professional, mm-hmm. and a cat shows up, says, my name is Miracle, and do this. And her doctor listened to her and mm-hmm. did it, because she wrote everything down, and she survived and is well. And again, it's, how does this happen? So that's why I found that I wanted to know what people intuitively knew was right for them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they drew the operating room and it was hell, I either reprogrammed them or could say, don't have surgery, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if they drew it as heaven and said, I'm afraid of the surgery, I'm afraid of chemotherapy, I said, but look at the beautiful picture you drew.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's good for you. Mm-hmm. Then we could calm their intellect and off they would go and do well.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So when you were four, jumping back to your scenario where you choked on a toy, which is kind of an interesting metaphor right there, did you see anything on the other side? Did you have a...
Well, I didn't go... It wasn't, in a sense, dead long enough.
Hmm.
Because what happened, I had taken... It was a toy that they wouldn't make this way. It was a telephone. And the dial part was screwed in. So I unscrewed it, put the pieces in my mouth, because we'd had some carpenters working in our house who had nails in their mouth.
All right.
Take them out and go bang, bang, bang. And so then I aspirated. And it's a very unpleasant way to die.
Oh, boy.
With your ribs and diaphragm and everything sucking and no air going in.
Right, panic.
And so I was watching still myself, thinking my mother's going to come in and find me dead. And that was the only thing that bothered me, that it would upset my parents.
Hmm.
But my choice was to get out of here, that it was more interesting out of the body than in it.
Hmm.
And then the kid on the bed went through, like, what do they call, agonal contractions and threw up and... With the vomiting, all the toy pieces were dislodged,
uh-huh.
like Heimlich maneuver would do.
Right.
So he started breathing again, and I had no choice. I mean, it was like I was sucked back in,
right.
mad as hell.
Wow.
And I yelled out, because I remember this distinctly, who did that? Because I had decided to die, and I wanted to know who the hell, you know, brought this kid back to life again. But again, as a four-year-old, I mean, this is such a vivid memory. I thought, well, there must be a God, and there's a schedule for all of us, and I'm not supposed to die now, so stop arguing and complaining. And, of course, by this time, my mother came running in, and, oh, boy.
You get back here right now.
Yeah, that was, you know, I didn't have a chance to say, I've just had a wonderful spiritual experience, you know. The kid almost jokes to death. You're not interested in that.
That's funny. Well, I just want to say something very quick, that when I was little, I used to go into the place that I called the little brown velvet me, and I knew I'd never died and I was never born, and I used to wonder why people didn't talk about that. So that's what that little story reminds me of, that place I used to go out of choice, you know?
Yeah, I really feel that, and there are many examples, the consciousness is non-local. I think it explains what we call past lives.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that when each of us is born, the word I use now is we're impregnated with the thoughts of that have preceded us, so we have some memories. And, oh, boy, some people have sent me some YouTube things about kids who, oh, I mean, when I say, oh, you know, when your child is interested in airplanes when he's a little child and talks about people and how the plane crashed in World War II, and when the parents begin to research what this kid is talking about, they find out he is exactly right. They get in touch with people in the squadron of the man who died and that their son is talking about, and they show up at their home with pictures of the squadron, and the kid knows the names of the people in the picture.
Oh, my Lord. Isn't that exciting?
And this is on YouTube that somebody sent me. I mean,
oh, you know, I got to look for it.
You cannot deny.
Mm-hmm. That's very exciting.
Yeah. And also, I have an animal intuitive friend named Amelia Kincaid, and I didn't believe in that either. See, what I learned is I don't deal with my beliefs. I deal with my experience. So when Amelia says, I talk to animals, it's like, yeah, right. But then when one of our pets disappears in Connecticut and Amelia's in Los Angeles, I said to her, okay, tell me where to find it. Without even getting a photograph, which she asked for of clients, she emailed me one day saying, the cat's alive. I'm looking at the moon through its eyes. And she described the house in such detail that I went out and got the cat the next morning. And it had been missing for weeks. I mean, we live in a wooded area. I thought it was dead, you know, caught by some other creature. And again, so what do I believe now? Yeah. And she taught me how to communicate with animals.
Oh, that's great.
And the key for all of us about our life is the symbolism of water. If it isn't still, you don't see your reflection. So you need to quiet your mind. Then you can communicate with yourself as well as with other creatures. But if you're busy thinking and worrying and frightened, you never get into that state.
Yeah, that's true. So I'm going to jump around, although I love what you're talking about. I'm also an intuitive, so I know a little bit about that world as well. But I'm very interested in how you, as a medical doctor and also as a paradigm shifter and as a very conscious man, how do you deal with this whole healthcare crisis that's going on? I published the article you'd written on in Bernie Siegel, MD.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Politics wears me out.
Me too.
And, well, I'll tell you, maybe this is the best answer because Lieberman, you know, who's getting a lot of news, comes from Connecticut. There's a congresswoman, Rosa DeLauro, who was kind of mad at him and he mad at her, but Rosa taught me something. She had cancer many years ago, and we were both speaking at a Relay for Life conference and meeting. And I said to her before we got up to speak, I said, you know, a lot of people know me, so I can get elected easily, but I've given up politics, I said, because I can't stand when you want to do something good for people, and all you do is have committee meetings for years and nothing happens. I said, I get so frustrated. And that includes at the hospital, too. And Rosa said, no, Bernie. She said, it's about our potential. She said, there are laws that I've worked on that have taken 5 years, 7 years to get passed, but they're passed and they're helping people. And I'd say, I wish every politician had her perspective. What is our potential? How can we help people? You know, rather than what's good for this business or that business or me. Let's not depersonalize everybody. Let's ask what would be good for the people in our country. And to me, yes, I'd like people not to have to worry about if I get sick, I can't afford my own care. But what I'd also like is for every child to grow up loved so they have self-worth and care for themselves. Because to me, I mean this, that's the biggest public health issue on the planet, that when you grow up with love, you experience one-fourth the illness rate of children who grow up and say, my parents didn't love me. And what they experience is almost 100% of serious illness by the time they get into, you know, their 50s and so forth. Because, well, let's look at things like cigarettes, obesity, addictions. That is not done out of stupidity. Okay? That has a lot to do with how you brought up, what are you searching for, all the unhealthy reasons for becoming an addict that relate back to your life. So I always say we need to inspire. And see, I would reward people for their health.
You know, I like that idea. That's a great one.
Because if you're a good driver, you might get a discount on your insurance.
Exactly.
You've never had an accident. Well, if I've never had a serious illness and I'm not taking any pills, and I'm not costing anybody any money, why don't you send me $1,000 at the end of the year and say, here, enjoy yourself. You stayed healthy. But instead, you know, we look at, yes, I want to protect people who get sick, and I'm not blaming them, but I would say also reward good behavior. And
but it's sort of an interesting fight on the planet or in this country, isn't it, that so many people are so panic-stricken about having health coverage I'm a Canadian and now living in this country, and I'm confused by that. I'm like, wow, you'd think that they would be tickled to finally be not having to go bankrupt or whatever if you have a big illness. I agree
well,
with you about
the
love.
Well, when it gets political, yeah, that's why, as I say, who is speaking? You know, if it's, I'm not saying drug companies are bad people. They,
no.
When they get sick, they have problems too. But if you're thinking about how can I make more money, say, mm-hmm. how can I put more drugs out,
mm-hmm.
What I would do as president, yeah, is I would give the companies who show me that there are, you know, things that you don't patent, like certain drugs, but if they showed me this vitamin, mm-hmm. like the way vitamin D has so many benefits, mm-hmm. and there are certain herbs that have benefits, and if they said, look, we've done research, this works, I'd say, fine, here, we'll pay you for the research. And you will have a tax benefit because mm-hmm. you've done this, see, versus, oh, I came up with a new pill. Now I can make millions of dollars by mm-hmm. patenting it. Let's show people how to stay healthy and reward the companies that do that as well as the people who do it.
I like that idea. And there's so many people that feel disempowered by, like, the whole drug medical thing,
yeah.
the lobbyists.
Again, medical education has to be changed, too, because this was an ad that I got canceled by writing to the journal and the drug company. It was Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm depressed, unable to cope. I went to see my physician. I said, you've got to help me. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel wonderful now. I wrote them. I said, I've got to tell you something. I'm depressed because my family was killed in an accident. And the doctor doesn't even say to me, why are you depressed? What's happened in your life? So would you do me a favor and put that line in your ad? And they canceled the ad.
Yay!
But you see, this is what bothers me. You go in and say, I'm depressed. Here's your paper. Here's your prescription. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there are healthcare, you know, providers who, and I mean this, doctors who are criticized for talking to patients.
Mm-hmm.
I get letters from them, say, where they're timed and they're told you're speaking 5 more minutes a patient than everybody else in the department, so you're not getting, you know, you're getting a smaller salary.
Mm-hmm.
That again, see, hurry up. But what we know again from studies, if you come out of a doctor's office, say, the doctor listened to me,
mm-hmm.
you're more likely to take your medicine and respond. Oh, another recent study, if you have a compassionate doctor, you get over your cold a day sooner than if you don't have a compassionate doctor.
Interesting. Who's doing the studies, Bernie?
I mean, these are all kinds of different journals and articles. I don't keep track of them,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, because I read them and I go, oh, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is kind of the swell of consciousness.
Done, yeah.
It's great. It's very exciting. So I notice a lot of people are much more conscious of their own empowerment in spite of, you know, the healthcare debates that are going on. There are a lot of people that are thinking about who they are and how
to
get
what
there.
I try to do is get people to be what I call a responsible participant. I call mm-hmm. them respites. Yeah, don't be a good patient. A patient is a submissive sufferer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're more likely to die in the hospital of medical errors, you know, if you're somebody that they don't really recognize because you just lie there quietly agreeing with everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I want people to be individuals, characters, so that their doctors, nurses know them as a person
mm-hmm.
and then don't make mistakes and don't operate on the wrong parts. So people need to feel that empowerment. But a lot of people are, because of how they're brought up, afraid to do those things.
Talk about aging, Bernie.
Well,
it's such a good subject because there's a lot of us going to do it.
Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be.
Mm-hmm.
I always say grow young along with me, the best is yet to be. Because this is just an interesting reflection I had. When you lose track of time, in other words, you're doing something that really interests you, and you lose track of time, my thought was, how can you age if you never know what time it is? How does your body know? I mean it. You know, what time it is. And I have found also that I'm totally unaware of my body when I lose track of time. So I can have a variety of aches and pains, be operating on someone, painting a picture, and have no pain at all for hours and hours until I'm done doing whatever I was doing. And that's what I'd like to say to people as part of survival. Find what makes you lose track of time. One of our kids said it well. I said, you have 15 minutes to live, what would you do? He said, I'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it. And he was enlightened, obviously. And other people, you know, I was saying, wow, that doesn't sound too great. And they said, no, that's my chocolate ice cream. I said, okay. So I tell everybody, go find your chocolate ice cream. Now, I say that because you might pick something that I wouldn't agree with, but that's not, you know, it's not for me to judge. It's, if it feels good for you, go do it. And I think that's an aspect. And the other things, yeah, what would I say to people? So again, some recent studies that I was reading this morning, that if you're active, exercising regularly, I mean, every doctor knows that. It's good for everything.
Right.
But that, again, your what's called your telomeres, it's part of your chromosomal makeup, they don't age. They don't break off at the ends and age as quickly if you exercise.
Oh,
so
that's
again,
good.
I'd say laughter, exercise, yes, eating the right foods, all of these things contribute to, oh, I don't know if you saw it in the paper the other day. You know who Jack LaLanne was?
Oh, sure, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he's 95, and it said in the paper he had to have surgery on his heart valve.
Hmm.
And he said to the family before surgery, I can't die. It won't be good for my image. I love it. He's 95.
He's 80. Cute, yes.
Yeah, and when you have that kind of sense of humor, and again, you're not trying not to die.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I always say to people. Don't try not to die, because when you do, you'll get to heaven and you'll be bitter and resentful for all the things you did. But do things because they improve the quality of your life.
And I think going back to your authenticity is getting the more authentic you are, you
mm-hmm.
know, the more ready we are to die in the sense of, you know, wanting to release later because we really have found that magic of who we are.
Yeah.
At least that's how I like
it. And, you know, I mean, there's so many things related to aging and death that women live longer than men with the same cancers. And it's about their connections and relationships.
I was just going to ask you about relationships, because here, Exercise 97, in this wonderful book, you talk a lot about the origin of wedding rings and then how people would do well to honor their relationships on a regular basis.
I mean, that's really what gives our life meaning. I hear men say, I can't work, what's the point of living? Now, you hear women say, which I talk to them about, I can't die till you're all married and out of the house, talking to their kids. But I tell them, so when the kids leave home, you die? You know, that's why I get back to don't live a role. Don't just be mama, say, or the wage earner. What are you here for? What gives your life meaning? And there was a gentleman named George Halas who owned the Chicago Football Bears. And apparently he was in his office one Sunday when somebody walked in looking for something. And they said, George, you know, what are you doing at your age working on Sunday? And he said, it's only work if there's someplace else you'd rather be. And that's what people need to understand. That you find, again, what feels right for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you live that message. And you learn, this is an important statement, to say no to things you don't want to do. So a friend, a family member could ask you to do something. You don't want to do it, your answer is no.
No.
Because otherwise you're saying no to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And one more that I got to add, that a study done on people with heart attacks, when you talk about relationships, go home to a house with a dog. A year later, 5% of the people had died after a heart attack. If you didn't have a dog, 26% had died.
Interesting.
This was done in Australia, and the doctor there had a sense of humor. He said, if everybody in Australia had a dog, we'd save $145 million a year in medical care. Now, you know, but
now
again,
that's brilliant.
You see, why is it scientific? Again, studies are done. You pet a dog, oxytocin and serotonin levels go up.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the bonding hormones. So you relate to people differently. Oh, and any single women listening, got to tell you this statistic. One study, 40% of women said the man they married, they met walking their dog. So I always tell single women, get or rent a dog and go for a walk, and your chances of getting married increase.
And people in marriages or long-term relationships live longer and are healthier, are they not?
Yeah. Married men live longer than single men with the same cancers, and they can smoke as much and have less lung cancer. So again, you see how the chemistry of the body is altered, and the genes don't decide because it's the message that the genes are given.
Hmm.
And I have to say, with my, you know, my humor, what pops into my head, because we have two dogs and other animals, and when I walk the dogs, I'll come home, my wife will always say, honey, who did you meet today? I think she's worried about the women who see me walking the dog.
you're going to shift her biochemistry if you're not careful.
Right.
Let me see. What do you, this is a kind of a, maybe a tough question. How do you see the medical lay of the land changing over the next little while? Or what would you like to see outside
like
of love?
See,
but you've already
part of what I'm always talking about is that we treat people's experience, you know, not just the diagnosis. So if you're depressed, not here's an antidepressant. If you have cancer, here's your chemotherapy. But what's going on in your life? What are you experiencing? Because people can have the same diagnosis, but it becomes a different experience for them. I mean, they'll come up with emotional feeling words that relate to their life. Mm-hmm. So I think that we don't just treat the physical, we treat the person's experience and life and help them to heal their life.
That's kind of the homeopathic system, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, some of our family have used homeopathy. I've used it with Lyme disease, and it helped me more than all the antibiotics and everything else.
Great. Well, that's good news, too.
Yeah.
But it also goes right into who you really are, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. See, that's what's interesting. Again, when you compare homeopathy, they sit and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so three people can have the same disease and get three different homeopathic remedies mm-hmm. because their personalities and lives are different. But the doctor doesn't. In other words, if I go in with Lyme disease, they sit and talk to me and say, okay, this is your remedy.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go to a doctor, it's here's the antibiotic.
Yeah.
See? And everybody gets the same one.
Right.
And I'd say it's just as important for the doctor to say, what's going on in your life? Let's look at more than just what antibiotic to give you, but what may have made you vulnerable. How do we help your immune system, you know, to really enhance my ability to heal my life and myself?
Well, what do you think of the swine flu? Obvious question, huh?
Well, I worry less about it, you see, because, again, it doesn't mean that lovers don't get, you know, some diseases, but a lot fewer.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say if you're out there loving and enjoying life, your resistance is going to be much better than somebody who's next to you who's depressed.
Right.
So what I would say to people is, yes, you want to get the vaccine, fine, go ahead. But I would say also, what makes you vulnerable? I mean, I ended up in the hospital with a severe infection, staph infection, many years ago when I always blame my wife because we had three kids and she gave birth to twins. So we had five kids under the age of seven. And the two of us got sick. I mean, we were exhausted.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, and then we learned, ask for help, get babysitters, ask people to come and help you. But I realized I was vulnerable because of how exhausted I was. So that's when I began also to relate it to patients and say, hey, did you have another kid, move, get a new job? And they'd look at me like, how did you know?
Good.
So I began to see that you can't separate your life from your health. I mean, I have given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to people with tuberculosis.
Oh, wow.
I thought I was out of my mind. But I just couldn't help it. I mean, I cared about this guy, and I had to do it.
But you didn't get tuberculosis.
No. That when I walked out of the room and the nurses said, you're crazy, I said, no, I will not get sick. I did it out of love, and I really felt invulnerable.
Yay.
As crazy as that may sound.
No, that's a wonderful story, Bernie. That is just a brilliant.
Yeah. And I'm not the only one who has ever felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think when you're giving out of love, you change your immune system, literally. I mean, there are a lot of books written about love and the advantages of it. But I think it is life enhancing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're depressed, well, this will confirm it. This was done by a graduate student at the University of South Florida many years ago. I mean, now we have other proof, but I thought it was fascinating because as part of his graduate study, he took actors and gave them scripts. And while they were acting, he drew their blood. If they were in a tragedy, their immune function went down, their stress hormone levels went up. If they were in a comedy, immune function went up, stress hormone levels went down. And there were other studies with college students. And what was interesting, because it confused one professor, he told them, you know, they were coming to see Mother Teresa and then some other, you know, like tragic thing. And when they came in, knowing they were going to see Mother Teresa and comedy and things of this sort, oh, their immune function, everything was wonderful. So he thought, well, then the movie doesn't make a difference. But then he began to realize the differences in what they're anticipating. They're looking forward to something, and it's already improving them.
Hmm.
Whereas the ones who knew they were going to see some negative image had the opposite effect.
So their immune system was already getting freaked out.
And so the same is true when you're riding to the hospital. Your immune function is going down knowing you're going to get chemotherapy.
Hmm.
And that's why it's important, your belief systems. Oh, well, let me add one more, how important the mind is. A radiation therapist was very upset. He said, we realized we repaired the machine a month ago and didn't put the radioactive material back in. We realized it when we did our routine monthly inspection. He said, I feel awful that we didn't treat anybody for a month. I said, you don't know what you're saying. He said, what do you mean I don't know what I'm saying? I said, you'd have to be a total idiot to not know you weren't treating people. I said, you obviously had tumor shrinking and people having side effects of your treatment. They all thought they were being treated. And his eyes bulged open and he said, oh my God, you're right. Yeah. And that's what impresses me about the mind. You believe you're being treated and you act as if you are. And that's why, you see, that word act as if you're the person you want to become and rehearse and practice. You can act like a survivor. You look at your potential, see, and you keep saying, what can I accomplish? What can I do? And you act as if you're that person.
Wow, and we have to draw to a close, but I want to remind everybody to tune in to Bernie Siegel, MD, your website, but also 101 Exercises for the Soul, hot on the heels of 300, and, what's the actual title?
365 Prescriptions for the Soul, and the others, 101 Exercises for the Soul.
I really recommend both of those, and I am just so pleased that you're on the planet shifting the paradigm like you are. You've made such a difference already, and it's not going to stop here.
In closing, let me say this. If anybody listened to this program and was inspired, don't give me credit. It means the inspiration is in you, and you'll accomplish some wonderful things. Because that's what I've learned, that what we see in others is within us. So I look for people who think I'm wonderful because it means they're wonderful.
That is so, I'm so grateful. So best of the season to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Bless you.
All right. Bless you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for another week of Paradigm Shifting. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to talk to me, suggest a guest, or give me some feedback, or book a session with me, it's veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. Remember, no H in Entwistle. And I love hearing from you all, and I hope that we're all having a wonderful and joyous holiday season, however you celebrate it.